from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Campbell. Today I'll get a preview of the first half of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's season.
Then I'll find out why The Winter's Tale is being performed in the summer.
I'll talk with writer Chris Forehand, who has a new memoir, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra is exploring the Roaring Twenties, Christopher O'Reilly, and contemporary composers. And that's just this fall. Sharon Gamble invited the ICO's music director, Matthew Kramer, and executive director, Elaine Eckert, to tell her about the start to the orchestra season and a special contemporary music festival this fall.
So, Matthew, is this the first season that you fully programmed? Last year, you inherited some programming?
That's correct. Some of the pieces were already in place, mostly soloists for last season. But this is designed completely from scratch, and it really allowed us the opportunity to think outside of the box what we wanted the ICO to look like, not only this season, but I've already put pieces in place for 17-18 as well. So we're always thinking about this, like putting a menu together.
And you kind of have to do it ahead of time because?
Well, in many respects, soloist schedules are booked that far ahead. In addition to new works, for example, if we want to be part of a consortium for a world premiere, the planning for that starts years ahead of time. So
Right. We're
always in contact with guest artists, with composers, and really within the industry to see what people are thinking about 2 or 3 years down the road.
And you need time to get scores in hand to study, and as well, possibly more often than we all think about, you hire extra players, not just the featured soloist, but a piece might call for more cellos than you have in your regular ensemble,
that's
right?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That each piece really that the chamber orchestra performs has a different complement of musicians. That, if it's, for example, next season doing a Hindemith Kammermusik, which, is scored for a very small number of musicians, followed immediately by the Nielsen Concerto, which has a different complement altogether. And so really it's kind of fascinating from an audience perspective to see people walking on and off the stage wondering what those empty chairs are for the next piece, for example. So we're very malleable in that regard.
And meanwhile, and this is for both of you, Elaine, feel free to chime in. You're programming for the audience, but you're also programming for your musicians. So do you ever get any pushback? Flute section comes and says, hey, we need more.
Musicians are not shy about offering their input about repertoire. And that's the great thing about it is that I think if we do program great music, it might not be a particular work, your cup of tea, but you can appreciate its qualities of what makes it a masterwork if it's by a well-known composer 100 years old or if it's a new work that's getting played by orchestras. There's just so much available, and we really only ever scratch the surface, it seems, as orchestras in this country. I mean, European orchestras play a wide variety of different composers that we've never heard of in this country, living composers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it interesting to always figure out where the war horses are going to go. We're always going to have those Mozart symphonies, the Beethoven symphonies, but how to complement those works with exciting new music or unfamiliar works by familiar composers. So it's always a little bit of a test to put the pieces in place.
And speaking of just touching the surface, I know in the short time we have in this conversation, we won't be able to talk about all the programming, but you really have a lovely assortment of pieces that are a little off the beaten path, contemporary pieces and as well as those pieces you just referenced that don't get programmed very often.
I'd like to just offer a comment about how important I think this is from the audience perspective. And I'm speaking not as Elaine, the administrator, but Elaine as an audience member of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra for the last couple of decades. When one is programming for the audience, you have to have the war horses, as Matthew calls them.
Yeah.
But I know that my musical taste and knowledge has certainly expanded by the exposure to the works that the chamber orchestra has programmed. And I think Matthew's done a fabulous job of introducing some new things that are new to me and will be new to some of our audience members. And you have to ride this very fine line of putting people off to say, oh, I don't recognize anything here,
mm-hmm.
or going too far extreme to the other way of saying, oh, gee,
I've heard that 13 times already.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I this is not always an easy balance to strike. I think for the chamber orchestra to be a vehicle for discovery is very, very important for our audience. And I think Matthew is extremely qualified to be leading us along down this path.
In a gentle way.
Kicking and screaming.
That's important.
No, not kicking and screaming.
Yeah, Very tuneful.
Yeah.
So you're actually starting out in October with Christopher O'Reilly, who most of our listeners will recognize from the top, a pianist, and in a very accessible piece, the Beethoven Second Piano Concerto. But tell us about the Gruber piece that opens that program. And is he related to the Gruber who wrote Silent Night?
No, he's not. But
darn it.
He is a Viennese composer. This is our kind of our Night in Vienna program.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher, of course, just an acclaimed pianist with the Beethoven. But the Schubert Second Symphony is also on that program. But the H.K. Gruber, a piece called Charivari, is a fascinating work. Really, I want to say in the mold of Ravel's La Valse, it's really a deconstruction of the Strauss Perpetuo Mobile.
Ooh.
And so actually the piece, it's not listed in our program, but the piece does start with the Strauss, which is only 2 minutes long.
Oh, okay.
And segues directly into this piece, which it starts off delightful and then suddenly begins to become, you know, this deconstructed and morphed and put back together. Like, for example, the Ravel was Ravel's reaction to the First World War and the atrocities that he saw, and he deconstructed a waltz.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so Gruber does the same thing, a nod to the history of his Austrian people who always have a habit, he says, of looking on the brighter side of things when things, in fact, are decaying. They're looking to the golden era of their past instead of addressing the problems of the future. So it is a very accessible piece, but again, it really is kind of a mind bender in ways, and it's only about 10 minutes in length. But I felt a very bright, virtuosic piece for the orchestra to start off the season with.
Mm-hmm. Fun. And then you spend the rest of the concert. I have to ask if Charivari is in B flat major, because the Beethoven and Schubert both are.
Just out of coincidence, those other two happened to line up that way.
No. In November, you were talking about the Hindemith a little bit ago, and it's a really interesting assortment of pieces inspired somewhat by jazz, right?
That's exactly right. The Roaring Twenties, we're calling the program, and all of these works came out of the 1920s, and many of our listeners will recognize that classical music reached a very important turning point in the 20s with the likes of George Gershwin in this country and Kurt Weill in Germany, of incorporating popular music and popular idioms into classical art forms. So Gershwin with his Rhapsody in Blue, of course, really turned heads in this country. But Kurt Weill, very much the same thing. So with Hindemith's Kammermusik, the Kurt Weill suite from Suite from Threepenny Opera, and two works by Gershwin which many people won't recognize, the Lullaby, which is the delightful work for strings, and the Primrose Overture from his musical Primrose. A wonderful assortment of works that incorporate popular music and the jazz from the 1920s. In addition to an incredible soloist on that program, Mimi Steelman, who is a virtuoso flautist playing the Nielsen Concerto, which is not jazz influenced, but does come right from the middle of the 1920s.
And not programmed very often.
No, and I'm never sure why. Nielsen is a very tricky composer. Many musicians love his symphonies. The concertos are incredible works. But, you know, I think when people are exposed to Nielsen, they walk away appreciating Nielsen.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it just is, you know, looking on a program, you don't go, oh, it's just not, it hasn't, doesn't have
it's
the name recognition.
It's not part of your household vocabulary yet.
Exactly.
Yet.
But a very important composer from the early 20th century.
Yeah. And then back to something deeply familiar in a tradition for everybody, Messiah in December, with lovely soloists, some of whom or all of whom you've worked with before.
I have not had the pleasure of working with Mitzi Westra yet, but she is a favorite of our audiences here in Indianapolis. So I look very much, and I have heard her perform, a glorious voice. But mm-hmm. I have worked with the other singers on this that we're inviting, Shari Gruber, who was our soprano last year. I've worked with her on several occasions. John McVeigh, who is an acclaimed Messiah singer, and Timothy Lefebvre, who's on faculty at Oberlin University, is a wonderful voice as well.
Now, so from the audience perspective, the baritone and the tenor will be new mm-hmm. to the audience. The soprano and the mezzo, Shari Gruber and Mitzi, have sung with us before. But the other two will be making their debut with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra.
Which is always great to hear music that you know with a voice that might be new to you.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And there's so much more to the season, but I think we're going to probably have to have you back to talk about the second half of the season, because I want to spend a little time talking about the Earshot readings. Tell me what Earshot is and how you got involved.
Earshot is a program of the American Composers Orchestra, an orchestra based in New York City that has a history for several decades now of premiering and performing the works of living American composers. Mm-hmm. They've outsourced reading sessions to prominent American orchestras over the past decade, orchestras like the Seattle Symphony, Nashville Symphony, Columbus, Ohio Symphony, and the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra now has the distinction of being the first chamber orchestra to do one of these readings.
That's great.
What happens is that the American Composers Orchestra puts out a national call for scores to be submitted. Mm-hmm. And what we have are graduate students at the university level or professionals who are just entering, you know, the market basically as a young composer mm-hmm. who want the experience of having a professional orchestra read their piece. These submissions, sometimes 200 or more, are whittled down. I get a box of about 20 scores FedEx to me, and I spend some time going through it. And we end up between the list of mentors and myself choosing four composers to come here to Indianapolis to have their works read by the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. And what that means is that there are two sessions with the orchestra. The first one, we play the composer's works. The musicians provide feedback. We have three mentor composers, including Pulitzer Prize winner Melinda Wagner, Michael Shelley, who's on faculty at Butler, and Robert Beezer, who's the composer associated with the American Composers Orchestra. We all provide feedback to these composers and incorporate some of the changes that we make in the rehearsal process. The second night is a public concert that's free and open to the public at 7 o'clock, September 23rd. And the audiences can come hear these fascinating young composers. And I can speak from experience, having done three of these readings with the Buffalo Philharmonic, that several of these composers have extraordinary careers now. So you never know who will be part of this process in 5 or 6 years will be receiving commissions from major orchestras, as many of these composers have done.
That's really exciting. It's like in the world of contemporary theater, there are readings so playwrights can come and get feedback from directors and designers, and in particular from the actors. Tell me some of the kind of feedback from your Buffalo experiences.
Well, some of it can be quite candid and very direct. For example, a bassoon player in the orchestra was always very critical of composers writing outside of the range or writing passages that were impossible. Why would you write this at all if you didn't want it to sound?
Clearly, you've never played my instrument.
Harp players are never satisfied with the harp writing. So a lot of it is, you know, from the musicians, their feedback that are just directed towards their particular instrument and how the parts are written. The composers will always have feedback about the overall impression. Mm-hmm. I'll have feedback for them about how things are coordinated within the score and whether transitions work well, for example, or the orchestration is less than ideal. But these to understand that these are not amateur composers.
No,
these are composers who, you know, really have already written significant works and are looking for the opportunity to come away with a professional quality CD, which we provide of their work at the end of this, and to make connections not only with our orchestra, but with the mentor composers and to have this experience. So it is fascinating from an audience perspective to see how these things are deconstructed and put back together.
Now, I have to ask, is there time? So the reading happens, and then a couple of days days later the performance happens, is there time for the composer to revise? Let's say something is really broken. Is there time to revise before the performance?
They have to stay up all night. The first session's on the 22nd and the second's on the 23rd. So really it is an all-day affair for them from the moment they wake up. We have actually a lot of other things that are associated with this. Lectures. We have professionals in the industry who come in and speak about copyright laws, who talk about the new software programs for composers. There are symposiums that will actually be taking on place on the campus of Butler University, who is our partner for this. Well, there'll be actually a new music festival built around this with other recitals, faculty recitals, and performances. So we really want to turn it into a week-long affair. But the chamber orchestra's portion of this is this public reading on the 23rd.
Fantastic. And that is free. And Elaine, I want you to just mention briefly that you have different kinds of ticket packages for the rest of the season. So if somebody can't commit to all of them, you have a flexible package.
Absolutely. We try to accommodate all schedules. We have the full season, which is essentially a ticket to each one of the seven concerts. Then you can, another option is to purchase a concerto pack, which includes tickets to four of the seven concerts that each feature a particular concerto. And we have such great variety in our concerto artists this year. In October, it's piano. In November, it's flute. In January, it's cello. And in May, it's violin. So that's what the concerto pack would do for you. And then we have a package we call Chamber Choice, which is completely flexible. And it is also a package of four tickets, which can be used in any combination.
So for use all
any
four
of
on
the
one
seven.
Concert or
one at
them
a time,
yeah.
Four at once. And we sell the concerto, the Chamber Choice package. I mean, we sell it all season because you could, I mean, you know, you could end up buying one just in the spring if you know you can't come to anything in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
You could still get a four-ticket package or even two four-ticket packages and use them for a couple of the concerts in the spring. So, yes.
Lots of variety.
Yeah, lots of variety.
Sharon Gamble with ICO Music Director Matthew Kramer and Executive Director Elaine Eckhart. The season starts September 23rd, and you can learn more at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Heartland Actors Repertory Theater, or HART, is producing The Winner's Tale for their annual free Shakespeare in the Park, the White River State Park, that is. Travis DiNicola spoke with actors Ryan Artsberger and Rob Johansson and with director Robert Neal about their production.
Three of my absolute favorite actors in this city, incredibly talented gentlemen. And goofballs, but seriously, it's great that the three of you are here, and you're all a part of HART. Who wants to start out by telling people a little bit of the background of what HART is?
I can start
Robert?
That. HART. This will be our eighth summer at White River State Park doing free Shakespeare.
Yeah.
This year we're doing The Winter's Tale, which is
Winter's Tale in summer.
Exactly,
okay,
yeah.
Okay,
I know.
That in a second. But okay, but this year you're doing Winter's Tale.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just a fabulous event in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
We have food trucks, the Indy Food Truck Alliance. We have beverages like Sun King Brewery. And people can bring picnic baskets and their own beverages. And it's just probably one of the most beautiful vistas in the country to watch outdoor Shakespeare.
It is.
Yeah. There at White River State Park over the White River and the old Washington Street Bridge that goes over the river and the sun setting behind. And when you look behind, it gets dark. You see the lights from the city. And it really is one of the most magical times in the summer to come and see our three performances, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd.
Of July.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great space. It's just sort of south of NIFS and the NCAA building
right,
and
yeah.
all that. And it's sort of an amphitheater that was built there, I mean, like into the grass.
Yeah, and people bring lawn chairs. We provide also chairs that people can rent there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a beautiful night to watch outdoor Shakespeare. There's nothing like, in my opinion, Shakespeare outdoors. There's
mm-hmm.
something about it. I mean, it was originally produced that way, and it's just a fantastic thing.
And three nights, and it's free.
It's completely free. Of course, the food trucks and that's that is. And we also have premium seating if people want to sit at tables. But it's absolutely 100% free to
so
come and see the show.
So they can buy a table if they want. But, so how is it free? I mean, you guys must have some great
Yes, we have
supporters.
Some fantastic sponsors. The Lilly Foundation, the Crystal Hahn Family Foundation, Central Indiana Community Foundation, White River State Park, of course. And printing partners, and of course we have a lot of in-kind and just individual donors who help us out. But that helps us to keep it free in the sort of the tradition of Joe Papp in the 1950s in Shakespeare in the Park and Central Park in New York City kind of started that whole movement. And we think Indianapolis is a great city, and we want to have a Shakespeare Festival here.
It's really a great thing. I've gone many years, and I've seen the quality, just from a technical standpoint, really improve over the years in terms of the sound, and because that can be a difficult space to amplify. And you do have actors using microphones in terms of the sets and the lighting. A couple of years ago, you did Tempest, which I thought was a perfect choice to have outside. But Winter's Tale, this one kind of threw me a little bit. How did you guys? How was this decided to do Winter's Tale during the summer? Who wants to jump in on that? Oh, you're all looking at
Brian.
I'm not
exactly sure how it was decided that Winter's Tale, other than it being an extraordinary play, it encapsulates both sort of ends of the spectrum that Shakespeare was genius at, which is sort of longing and pain and redemption, and within that is a little, well, not so little walnut of comedy and absurdity.
Winter's Tale doesn't seem to be taught as much in schools or produced as much. So maybe give me a brief description of what the play's about.
Well, it hinges on the jealous reaction of the character I play, Leontes, who convinces himself that his wife is cheating on him with his best friend. And he not only convinces himself, but he kind of goes insane. And banishes her and banishes the child that she bears from him. She appears to die. The baby is sent off into the wilderness. And then, so the first half of the play is that.
Okay.
The second half of the play is her having grown up off where she has been rescued.
Okay.
And there's some kind of country folk shenanigans that happens.
It's a funny play.
Yes, in parts.
In parts.
And deeply painful and moving in other parts. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think is so magical about Shakespeare is that he explores all extremes. And this play is a very good example of how good he was at both ends of the spectrum.
I know that all of you have done a lot of Shakespeare. Have any of you done Winter's Tale before? Or?
Nope.
Nope, first time?
Yeah, I've been in it twice before, many years ago, that I don't remember that much about, and they were mostly smaller roles.
Yeah.
So I kind of came to it with fresh eyes. And one thing I'll add to about the play that I love is that it's at the end of Shakespeare's career. I think the a lot of people think the first production was May 11th, 1611. And he was at the end of his career, and I think he just was throwing away, all of his tradition and said, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And he put together comedy, tragedy, and romance all in one play. And the verse lines are all kind of broken up. And it was just him, like a great artist, having mastered one form, is now breaking into a new one. Really 400 years, and in fact, it's 400 years since his death. But, he predated, Theater of the Absurd and everything else, 400 years ahead of time. So
this was experimental theater.
In a way, it was.
But also, along the lines of the broken up lines of verse, it's amazing what he achieved in terms of actual kind of naturalistic human thought, self-interruption, and changing your mind in the middle of a sentence.
Stream of consciousness
type
of.
It was incredible. Yeah. So it was... it was like it's deeply naturalistic at the same time that it's heightened.
Rob, what's your role in this?
I play Autolycus, who I'm more in the walnut of the wingnut walnut.
You're gonna have to explain that.
It's interesting because the play I watch. I do begin the play with the cast, but then I go away for a while. And watch this really, really dark situation unfold. And one thing that I love that Robert's doing with directing the show, about halfway through the show, there's something that happens. Can I say what the famous stage direction is?
Yeah, I think a lot of people will know that. Anyway.
People know in this show, it's exit pursued by bear. And I remember the first time
awesome.
That in undergrad that I was reading this play, uh-huh. and I know me, it was probably 2:30 in the morning, and I'm trying to cram this into my head. And I saw that, and I was like, what the hell is this? You've got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. Is this a joke? And the funny thing is, my instructor was like, no, that is not a joke. And I think he was incorrect, because our take, Robert's take, and I think it's correct, is, and now a patch of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know,
it sounds like a little Monty Python or something.
Right? Yeah.
Very much. Yeah, yeah, I think so.
And the good thing is that the play isn't quite to intermission yet when we see this moment of absurdity, which sends you into the land that I'm in, where I'm a conniver, I'm a pickpocket.
Street musician.
Yeah. And there's a lot of clowning going on in Act Two.
Okay.
And I actually, my first time that I saw this show, the bear attack was actually, it sounds so stupid, the bear attack was really serious, was completely, they tried to make it realistic, so it looked ridiculous in all the wrong ways.
Yeah.
Like, I found myself laughing at it like, this is the worst play on Earth. And it's not. It's brilliant because he does. He's juggling and colliding
two forms.
What's the film
with DiCaprio? So it's not like Revenant or whatever.
No. Maybe. No.
Maybe it's maybe. Revenant meets Revenant as told by Eric Idle. Yeah. I don't know. You know. Wow. Yeah, so it's a good mishmash.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that the audience will embrace both sides, you know, the comedy and the tragedy of it. Yeah.
Robert, what's your vision for directing this? I mean, is this a pretty straightforward what people would expect, or what else are you
bringing I don't know. I don't know what people expect. Some people, I imagine, expect, you know, Elizabethan costumes. We're definitely not doing that.
Okay.
It's sort of a modern, timeless is the way I think of it. Mm-hmm. It's now but not now. It can be kind of any time. I think of the two worlds as Cecilia being a kind of an urban conservative place and Bohemia being sort of like Portland, Oregon, a very liberal agrarian place.
Yeah.
Burning Man was certainly an image that we used a lot in that world. Like Rob was saying, that the thing that I love about the play is how bold it is. It's like, okay, let's go from literally the first part of Act One is like a Greek tragedy. It's so incredibly moving and powerful. And then, you know, just within moments, we go from that into that to that bear moment, which I think is Shakespeare leading us into the, like Rob said, the absurdity of it. And
kind of giving you a flag to say, hey, we're about to shift gears here.
You know, and in Shakespeare's day, the bear pits would have been right across the street from the Globe Theater, you know, so it had been something people could have recognized, you know. And then it goes into Bohemia and all that crazy, zany, hilarious stuff. And then we end up in a kind of a new way, in a romance at the end. So I just love the boldness of how Shakespeare constructed it. So it's, you know, it'll be very, I think it's very accessible.
Yeah.
Shakespeare's always very accessible to me and to people, I think, generally, when it's presented well. And I think that the actors are extremely specific. Literally, my job, in all honesty, as director, is I got the best actors in the world and I just kind of get out of their way. And that's the truth.
Yep.
Yeah.
So let me ask the two of you, well, all three of you, really, this question. Do you prepare differently knowing that the production is going to be outside at all? Does that change anything that you do in terms of how you approach your role? Or does it, I mean, do you even consider that, Ryan?
Bring more water. I mean, literally, I think that's about it. And maybe drink more water at home, because despite the fact that we're mic'd, it's still a pretty big draw on the vocal cords.
Yeah.
So,
physically, I would think, I mean, both in terms of the sound and, I mean, if you're dealing with the heat, too.
Yeah. But there is a little bit of a gestural broadening that you have to do, just by way of drawing the eye. So we're on, let's say, the Indiana Rep stage, you wouldn't raise your hand when you started to talk. You might do that in White River State Park just to get the audience to be like, oh, that guy's talking.
Yeah. You probably don't have to deal with, like, swatting away mosquitoes or fireflies either.
First show I did, the first one was, what was
Merchant
that?
Of Venice
Merchant
was the
of
very
Venice.
First one. Yeah.
And the bugs came out, and we had these, like, footlights, and I was, like, kneeling by one of the footlights, and I took a breath to say a speech, and a moth went into my throat.
Oh, man. Rob, you were...
I'm a rookie to this.
Yeah?
This is my first heart experience. I've seen, I think, six of the... You guys have done eight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a couple of things about that. This is one of those organizations that has been created by artists in town that wanted something different.
Yeah.
And that speaks to me, you know, created Shadow Ape, you know, me and Constance and Michael Brown, who's now in Chicago. But, you know, it's one of those things that I don't think any of us, Ryan, Rob, Robert, or myself would be here if IRT wasn't here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where
most people know you from, and you've all done a lot of work there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the cool thing, as you said, with Heart is that it's really actors, artists getting together that said, we want something else, too.
Right. Yeah. And there are a few places where you can make a living wage as an actor in town, the Phoenix IRT, and now there's more, mm-hmm. but... This is one of those organizations that you go, this was created by people who wanted something that was missing in our community. Mm-hmm. And you get to see it over how many years evolve into this happening.
Yeah.
Where thousands of people come. It's one of the reasons that I love being in this city, you know. And I know this happens in other places, but I've always
cool
felt
thing.
There's
it's a big event.
Special.
It's a big event. I look forward to
it. I just want to say we're led brilliantly by our producing artistic director, Diane Timmerman. And she really kind of makes the whole thing possible. So sort of organizes it all for us and makes it happen.
Travis DiNicola with Heart actors Ryan Artsberger and Rob Johansson and director Robert Neal. The Winner's Tale takes place this weekend, Friday and Saturday at the White River State Park. The pre-show festivities begin at 6 p.m. and include music, food trucks, and more, with the show beginning at 8 p.m. Lawn seats are free, with comfortable lawn chairs provided for you, no reservations necessary. Premium seats may be purchased in advance for a fee. More information at heartlandactors.com, H-E-A-R-T, landactors.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I'm so sad. All the stores are clearancing their summer items and putting all that back-to-school stuff in there.
There it goes.
There it goes. But we have some items to make you feel like it's still summer on our calendar. We call What Do We Do?
That's right. Well, I was just at an opening at the Long Sharp Gallery. That's the gallery on Illinois that is part of the Conrad. And there is a great exhibit called Crossroads New Media. And it's been extended through August. And it features works of Jason Myers, Michael Lasseter, and Constant Edwards Skopelidis, and her work. Not that the other gentlemen don't have some great stuff, but hers is pretty amazing. And you can touch it, which is very cool.
Ooh.
Yes, definitely worth checking out. Again, this is the Long Sharp Gallery at the Conrad. Really interesting new media.
And for a completely different kind of artistic experience, the Indiana Microbrewers Festival is coming up next Saturday. It's hosted by the Brewers Guild of Indiana, and more than 100 breweries are all in one location at Military Park. There are designated driver tickets, so line yourself up a designated driver friend and go check that out. It's from 3 to 7 p.m. next Saturday, July 30th. Taste lots of beer.
Very cool. Hey, Kathy Morris is playing on Saturday from 6 to 9 with Gary Walters. Jazz on the Monon. It's free outdoor concert in Carmel, Monon, and Main Street. Free for the entire family. Worth checking out.
Fantastic. Hey, it's a few weeks away, but it's not too soon to get online to indiefringe.org and start making your plans for the Fringe Festival, which is coming up August 18th through the 28th, and all kinds of crazy and wonderful artistic shows to check out, something for just about every taste, including something for kids. IndieFringe.org, Fringe Festival, August 18th through the 28th.
Very good. And you can always learn more about the local arts events at IndieArts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next weekend on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Writer Chris Forehand is primarily a poet, but a couple of years ago, one of his poems made him realize that he needed to write prose to help him untangle a mystery at the center of his family life, the suicide of his father when Chris was just 14. My Father Before Me is the resulting memoir, and Sharon Gamble invited Chris to read from and talk about the process of documenting the dynamics of his family.
So, because poets are all about language, and memoirists are as well, I'd like to ask you to read a couple of paragraphs. This is actually towards the end of the book for us.
Sure. I felt most at ease with language when the communication was one-way and scripted. When I was reading an announcement into the microphone during my morning radio shift, or in the privacy of my notebook, tinkering with syllables with the rhythms and whispery implications of them. Only a part of me was speaking then, a part I felt comfortable with, and no one talked back. So timorous in conversations with strangers, so used to stewing in my private juices, I began to sense that broadcast journalism was an imperfect career choice. At the heart of reporting is a genuine curiosity about other people and a relentless desire to learn the truth about them, especially uncomfortable truths, the ones they would prefer to conceal. Me, I didn't like to use the phone. At the grocery store, if the shortest line led to a noticeably chatty cashier, I chose the longer one. Before leaving my apartment, I peeked through the curtain to confirm that I would encounter no neighbor or postal worker with whom I might be required to converse.
So I realize I'm putting you in a difficult position by making you talk about your
okay,
talk,
I'm
period.
Happy
you know,
to
you're
do
a writer.
It.
And, you know, sometimes you would think that language is language and people who write are comfortable talking, and that's not always true. Mm-hmm. But I'm intrigued by this memoir, by the process, and by your personal process of having chosen as your first career path to go into journalism, broadcast news in particular, and I wonder if you knew at the time that what you were really doing was looking for the truth about your family? Did you make that connection?
No. If you can give me 5 silent minutes to contemplate that, maybe I'll make the connection. That, you know, I don't know. So many things go so far back. You know, people sometimes ask, how did you become a writer? I don't know. I loved language when I first started learning language. That's probably the beginning. Why was I so interested in broadcasting? Well, when I first heard the radio, when I was 3 or 4, I thought, well, this is interesting. So I don't know that there's a connection to the family. But what I do talk about in the memoir is, you know, what's important to me as, and this is important to most people, is some sort of meaningful interior life and some sort of you know, way of being that allows me access to that interior life. In other words, a life in which I'm not lying to myself. And certainly this book, this attempt to figure out my father, who he was, what made him end up doing what he did, taking his own life, that's a search for the truth. That's a confrontation to the best of my ability with who I am, what I think, how I feel. And I just found in my, you know, early career, which started really in high school, in broadcasting, I was having fun, but I just felt more and more that fun was disconnected from feeling meaningfully alive. Mm-hmm. Which is what writing makes me feel.
There's, in all kinds of broadcast, including, by the way, radio, there's a certain mm-hmm. amount of the person you really are is different from the persona, mm-hmm. and even more so in television. You talked about pancake makeup and hairspray, and
right.
it's just like what, the real you is somewhere deep inside there, but not externalized.
And as we sit here talking, I feel like a big phony because here we are on radio and I feel completely myself. You seem perfectly genuine. And in fact, I thought on the way over here, you know, we might talk about broadcasting. And certainly one way perhaps I could have continued to be in broadcasting and not feel so conflicted would be to you know, work for a public radio station and talk to writers and artists, sure. What have you. And in fact, when I spent a few years in television news, this was in Montana, in Great Falls, Montana, in the early 80s, you know, I very much felt this difference between what I cared about and what I was doing professionally. And I felt it in that as a news director at 23, I was a news director, you know, deciding the stories to cover. I would give my reporters the hard news stories generally, and I would go down to the art center and talk to some painter who was having an exhibition. And I realized, you know, this is the stuff I like to do.
Yeah.
And I'm somehow having to kind of do an end around, you know, around my normal professional obligations in order to make it happen for me.
This memoir, I kept thinking the word forensic kept coming to my mind because you were solving a mystery or attempting mm-hmm. to solve a mystery, and you tried all of these different windows to look into this dark house to try to figure out what's going on in there. How did you shape the memoir? And did it strikes me, too, that a writer is a writer, yes, but poetry is so different from prose, and fiction is so different from memoir. You talked a little bit before we turned the microphone on about a book of poems from 2009 that led you to the idea of writing the memoir. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Sure. The book is called Black Leapt In, and what happened was maybe 15 years ago, I felt stuck. There's something of a crisis in my poetry writing, which happens occasionally. You know, you hit this wall. And for various reasons that aren't worth going into here, I started writing a different kind of poem syntactically. I was actually using different kinds of sentences. And suddenly my father kept appearing in these poems. And I hadn't written about him for a long time.
I want to interrupt for a second. Mm-hmm. Was there something about the cadence that reminded you of his speech?
No.
That's
a good guess. It was actually, I found myself not using subordinating conjunctions. I wasn't saying because, while, therefore, and those sort of
You weren't
sort of
qualifying
words.
Yourself.
I wasn't forging rational relationships between things. I wasn't saying, because this happened, therefore this happened.
Yeah.
While this was going on, another thing was going on. This kind of, I just found myself not using that sort of language.
So you left the context out.
Right. And so what came bursting forth in the poems was feeling.
Oh.
Because, you know, a one-month-old isn't necessarily thinking, you know, because the lights have gone out, I therefore am feeling frightened. Just, wah!
Yeah.
So that's, I just love that this happened, and because it says so much about the mind, about psychology and the relationship between language and thought and language and feeling. So anyway, feelings about my father kept coming out, and I realized I had to keep writing in this way and writing about him. So ended up writing a book. It's called Black Leapt In. And I'll read a poem from it if I can.
Please.
It's fairly short. And so it's about my father, but in the way that happens sometimes with poetry, there are poetic liberties taken. That is, you know, the images are more metaphorical than literal. I hope the feeling is accurate. It does seem to me accurate. It's called 30-Year Elegy. And I did write this 30 years after he died. He died in right before Christmas, 1973. 30-year elegy. He paddled out, let the swell swallow him. Blind grappling hook in my brain, dragging the silt for him. It's what he left me. One thing bothered him into being, packed muscle and blood in him. It ripens the grape into wine, makes the park swarm with orphans. A mind that won't forget, that was my father's gift. fingering each misery like a fat coin, then dropping it into his pocket. His being back now, bashful but ready to tell it all, uncorking a bottle of something rare to share with his children, I did that. Now, you know, I was talking to a poet friend of mine who read the manuscript of this book, and he said, well, your father, he killed himself by drowning, right? I said, no. But in this poem, I say, he paddled out, let the swell swallow him, a metaphor, of course. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning. But here I realize this is a poem in which I'm trying to figure him out, and I'm doing it impressionistically with metaphor, trying to figure out what kind of person he was, what was compelling him to act as he did throughout his life and ultimately. And then at the end, I say his being back now, that is, I'm imagining him back in his life as if it was all just a big mistake. Mm-hmm. I say he's bashful, ready to tell it all, uncorking a bottle of something rare to share with his children. It's a nice fantasy. You know, it was all a big mistake. But I say I did that. And as a writer, I did that. I brought him back to life. And that's a poem that feels to me like about as far as I could go with poetry to engage with my memory of him and to, you know, confront him and what he was. Well, then my question is still, you know, well, what was he? and I realize, you know, I really don't know. I don't know facts about this guy. I don't know who his parents were. He never talked about
that. And you, in the memoir, you talk about the previous generations who are similarly MIA. They're just not there.
Exactly.
There's this deep mystery at the center of your family identity.
Yeah. So I wanted to go searching for that. And I realized this is not what poetry is for, at least for me. Poetry isn't, you know, about collecting facts and telling the story. And so I realized that if I'm going to do this as a writer, I'm going to be writing a book of prose. I had no idea how to do that. I'd never done it before. But I really was compelled. I wanted to know as much as possible, once and for all, who was my father? Where did he come from? Who were the people in his family before him? And so...
And what of him is in you?
And what of him is in me, right? And so, yeah, if you use the word forensic, it felt forensic to me, and I greatly enjoyed it at first. I delved into research. Mm-hmm. I wrote to every forehand I could find in the Seattle phone book, most of whom I didn't know, saying, I think you might be related to me. I don't know. These are the people I think are my ancestors. Do they sound familiar to you? I tried to contact people my father worked with. Most of them seemed to have passed by now, but I did find one who talked to me. Thank goodness for Ancestry.com. I knew nothing about my genealogy, and I found a treasure trove of documents. I found family members I didn't know existed, some of whom helped me greatly filling in the blanks. So a lot of the original research was genealogical. I didn't know anything about my father's parents. I'd heard just kind of whispery stories or his siblings. I certainly didn't know anything about his grandparents or the people before. So I had this hunch, well, if I'm going to figure this guy out, I'm going to have to figure out who this family was he came from. I ended up feeling, I don't know if that's really helping me. You know, one question just leads to another. Although, yes, you're right, there's a certain theme. I don't want to stereotype, but my father was Irish Catholic, pure Irish. Both of his parents were pure Irish, and you don't have to go back many generations to get to the old sod in our family. And what I found, looking back, to the degree that I could find facts about these people, generally the men were hard drinking, often they drank more than they should have, laborers who often tended to abandon their families. The women were good, upstanding, solid citizens, wives and mothers, or if not wives and mothers, nuns. Four of my father's aunts became Dominican nuns. And so there's something stereotypical about that. You know, the girls become nuns, the men become drunks and ne'er-do-wells. I exaggerate only a little. And my father's father abandoned his family when my father could barely walk. He was, I think, 1 year old. And then, you know, I discovered other things about my father's little brother drowning when my father was seven, and Skippy, the drowned boy, was five. And then my dad's mom died when my dad was 11. And so my dad, and then his other brother, the only other member of the family, Jim, left town as soon as he could and never looked back. So my father, I just visualize him as a 17-year-old, say, just standing there alone. Everybody's gone, except his grandparents who adopted and raised him in Seattle. This is the guy who ended up, by the age of 21, 22, having three children and a wife, and there were five more children to come. And I don't know how he did it for as long as he did. He was married for almost 25 years, but he ended up with eight children, a very difficult job as a CPA, as a treasurer for a lumber company. And but what I see is this man who had this pretty miserable childhood. It was all about loss. And he grew up at a time and in a culture in which we didn't talk things out. Men were expected to keep a stiff upper lip, and to a degree we still are. And I suspect instead of giving himself the time or being granted the time and the means to try to figure himself out and try to deal with these traumas and these losses, he just went to work. And he just, you know, delved into this life as a family man and as a career man. And in some way or another, that probably killed him.
Sharon Gamble with writer Chris Forehand. His new memoir is My Father Before Me. It's available at bookstores everywhere. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I find out about a new mobile phone photography competition.
Then I'll talk with Nate Heck about his TV show, Artrageous with Nate.
And I'll chat with Eric Grayson about guerrilla film preservation. That's G-U-E-R, not the other one. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.